Killer Innovations Podcast for Saturday, May 7th, 2005, show number 9, coming to you from Washington, D.C. Hello, and welcome to the podcast. Before we get started, please keep in mind that the opinions expressed in this podcast are mine and mine alone and do not necessarily reflect those of my past, current, or future employers. In today's podcast, we're going to cover the normal three segments. Segment number one, we're going to talk about second generation innovation tools. Segment number two, in weak signals, we're going to talk about the concept of human scale. And then segment number three will be the killer question of the week. So, let's go ahead and get started and talk about second generation tools. This is a pickup, or I should say extension, of show number 7, the April 23rd podcast, where I introduced the concept of what I called first generation tools. And these were some of the more basic tools that are used that we may come across today, such as maintenance tools such as suggestion systems or work teams, benchmarking, other tools that I talked about were crossover tools, etc. If you haven't listened to that show, I'd encourage you to go back and download the April 23rd show to kind of get some of the background on what I called first generation tools. So in today's podcast, we're going to talk about what I would call second generation tools. And this is, again, categories or families of tools that have been developed specifically to try to expand upon or help generate a broader view of ideas around innovation. So let's talk about some of these in a little more detail. So one that you may come across are what I would call dialogue tools. And dialogue tools are basically a form of creating an open channel of communication, an open sharing of ideas, beliefs, etc. You may also have referred this to social capital. And in the case of social capital, specifically, this is where there is a very broad and repeated form of communication between teams. And this allows for some kind of group or social agreement as to the objectives or the directions of the business or the needs of innovation or the areas of focus. So again, this is purely driven, or I shouldn't say purely, but heavily emphasized in the areas of social interaction, shared vision. You know, how do you get a shared vision across a wide team? It's through this social capital or what I would call dialogue tools. It's also an excellent way to build trust around common visions or common areas of focus for innovation. Dialogue tools are also great for team building. The key, though, with dialogues is diversity of the team. If you lack diversity, basically then with dialogue tools is you quickly end up with herd thinking. If everybody comes from the same background or is part of the same level within the management team or even works from the same department, then you end up all thinking the same, coming up with the same ideas, and there's really no diversity. The other key issue with dialogue tools is that it has to be ongoing and it has to be a continuous process. This isn't a one-time send a memo out, but it has to be a means of being able to get people together and use these dialogue tool sets in order to drive some kind of interaction. And again, make sure that these teams that you are getting together using dialogue tools are diverse. A second tool, and there's been a lot of press on this, is what I would call scenario planning. And what do I mean by scenario planning? And this, if you're not familiar with it, there's a number of excellent books that are up there. And in fact, I'll dig through my library here, a couple that I really like. One by Peter Schwartz, who really kicked off the whole concept of scenario planning when he was at Royal Dutch Shell. And the team there at Shell actually use scenario planning to predict the oil embargo of the 70s. A great read as a couple, like I said, of Peter Schwartz's books, and I'll put those up on the Killer Innovations website for you to take a look at. But when I talk about scenario planning, the concept behind scenario planning is that it's almost impossible to do any kind of innovation or strategy planning where you're trying to predict one and only one future. And basically, the concept behind scenario planning is that you have to work through multiple strategic alternatives. The fact is that things could happen a week from now, a month from now, or a year from now that will radically change what the outcome is going to be with regards to your plans or your directions or even the areas that you're focusing on with regards to innovation. And the benefit of scenario planning is it allows you to avoid the risk of planning for a single or a most likely future. And the outcome of scenario planning is that you would have two, three, four alternatives. And each of those alternatives are perfectly valid depending on things that happen in the future, such as change in interest rate, new regulatory requirements, increased costs of raw goods for your products or services, whatever the case might be. And again, the whole concept behind scenario planning is it maximizes your agility, it maximizes your flexibility to respond to those kinds of changes. So when thinking about strategy planning or even innovations, is to recognize that you need to be thinking about alternative futures, about things that possibly could happen, and to have multiple plans in place, multiple areas of focus of your innovations in order to give you the maximum flexibility, the maximum agility to respond. And actually, what I'll do is in an upcoming podcast, I'll actually probably dedicate one podcast just to scenario planning and how what that role is with regards to innovation. The third tool is one that I call the Merlin experience. And what I mean by Merlin experience is basically take your business or take your technology as it is today and project it into the future and then work your way backwards. So this is kind of, taking the sci-fi view of if you've got an existing product or an existing customer base, and you take them and you project them out 25 years into the future. And this is where you kind of get wild and crazy. And then what you do is you back up from that point to today and determine what are all the things that have to happen in order for that future to occur. And what you tend to find is that will unlock areas of gaps in technologies, gaps in innovation, gaps in business models, gaps in understanding of customers, and those again will open up a floodgate of possible areas or of possible ideas that you can look into. The next one is what I would call action learning. So this is number four, action learning. And what I mean by action learning is really it's around this whole area of how do you bring together teams to address a specific opportunity. And what I mean by action learning also is the fact that this team is very diverse. And in many cases with action learning is you want to get people who aren't directly familiar with the opportunity. And that's where the learning comes in. You put this team together. They're tasked with learning the area or the opportunity and then identifying the program or projects needed to address that opportunity, and then they own it all the way through. So it's kind of the old theory of if you've launched your team onto the beach and you burn the ships, there's no retreat. They have to figure out how to survive, they have to figure out what they should do to make it. They figure out how to deliver it, they own it, and they know they own it, and their success depends on the ability to make that successful. Fifth area for next or second generation tools is what I call practice fields. And practice fields is really an area that allows them to play out or simulate strategies, innovations, business models, markets, whatever the case might be. And again, it allows them to work it out such that you can prove out the opportunity in a safe environment that has little to no risk. In effect, giving them a sandbox in order to try out whatever the idea might be. Now, there are some software tools that are out there that allow you to create this, but in many cases, this could be as simple as taking a small team, having them build a proof of concept, and actually have them take that to market. If it's successful, then you expand it. If it's not successful, you fold it and you go off and you try the next idea. And basically, the concept here is that you test it fully before you're going to invest and make a full rollout of whatever the idea or the opportunity is. The sixth area is really around what I would call knowledge management or knowledge mapping. And this has kind of been the buzzword in a lot of industries for quite some time, is how do I capture all of the knowledge that's inherent within my organization, expertise within my people, knowledge about my business, products, processes, customer base, markets, etc. How do I capture it? And then how do I disseminate it across my entire organization to make my organization more responsive and overall increase the inherent knowledge of my organization by the fact that I'm leveraging these tools? Now, there have been a lot of successes and a lot of failures with knowledge management, knowledge mapping tools. And one of the real deficiencies in these tools today is that they do not tend to focus on how do I improve the innovation pipeline through the process of these tools. So how do I capture things about like competition or customer desires or whatever the case might be? And it isn't just the fact that you gain knowledge about that, but then how do you use that as input into the innovation process? And the key here is that the proper use of knowledge management and knowledge mapping tools can be an excellent source to feed the continuous innovation process. So again, just to summarize on the second generation tools, we have dialogue, we have scenario planning, the Merlin experience, action learning, practice fields, and knowledge management and mapping. And these aren't meant to be the exhaustive list, but these are kind of the families of second generation tools that I tend to think about when I'm thinking about all the possible tools that I can leverage for an opportunity with coming up with new ideas or areas of innovation. Let's move on to segment two. Segment two, weak signals. I want to talk about what I would call human scale. It's interesting when you think about the different input and output means that we as humans have, and how do you really use that to think about new concepts of ideas of products, services, or capabilities? I mean, we're all familiar with the interaction that we have with the keyboard. I mean, we all sit in front of our computers, or we're surfing the web, or doing email, whatever the case might be. And it's typically considered about average for a human to be able to type somewhere in the neighborhood of 35, 40, 45 words per minute. And that's actually a pretty good rate at the keyboard. And that's assuming a high accuracy rate. But did you realize that at the human scale level, that the top end for keyboarding is in the neighborhood of 212 words per minute? There's a woman by the name of Barbara Blackburn who's actually able to clock out at 212 words per minute at a 0.1% error rate in the typing. So when you think about it, that's pretty amazing. And when you think about also other areas of human skill, such as speech. Now, for those of us who've been around for a while and remember the old Federal Express ads where the guy is standing there doing the speed talking, and it's the FedEx ad talking about how fast they can deliver documents, And if you may recall, the guy in the ad is a gentleman by the name of John Machida. And John Machida has been clocked in at 568 words per minute as the world's fastest talker. And this can also kind of contrast with some of the efficiencies or inefficiencies of the human body. You know, today our primary input into computers and infrastructures is what? Typing. And technology is improving, but it's not quite there for the speech recognition. In fact, I've been trying to work on a book for quite some time. My biggest challenge is that I can typically think and talk much faster than I can type, and so I find it frustrating to get what's in my head down onto the keyboard and into some kind of document. I've tried all of the voice recognition pieces of software and have just not quite found one that's able to keep up or has a high enough accuracy rate where I don't spend hours upon hours going back and trying to edit the documents. Yet, the human scale from the standpoint of output is that speech is much faster than typing, but the technology has just not as kept up. But it's also interesting to point out that we also have, in the fact of the audio, the ability to even have a higher input rate, which is one of the reasons why I think podcasting has taken off to such a level. And scientists have measured the auditory nerve at about the same rate as a T1. So when you think about it, the ability to take input signals, being able to listen to the podcast, listen to music, have a conversation, is driven by the fact that our auditory nerve can clock that rate in at about a T1. Now, at the same time, our optic nerve has been clocked out at about a gigabit, which is one of the reasons why the human body is so good at visual recognition, pattern recognition, and the ability to quickly discern information from the visual cues. That's also one of the reasons why visual cues are so critical to our ability to interact out and about, whether that be the 3D stereoscopic, being able to view and see and estimate distances, to the ability to recognize family members for that matter. And it's also one of the reasons why, with the advent of color graphics, and for those of us who are old enough to remember the old 3270 green screen terminals, albeit that was a significant improvement, but still it never really quite saturated the ability for us to take input information. But now, with all the high-res graphics, computer games, high-definition television sets, you're now at a point where you can truly leverage a critical input means, which is the optic nerve. Now, what does all this have to do with weak signals? Well, the fact is that when you're looking for weak signals, those early hints of ideas, you have to not only try to identify what those weak signals are, but search around the edge of how do they apply. And one of the things that I've found successful is when I'm thinking about weak signals, is applying this concept of human scale. If I'm looking at a particular new opportunity, for instance, in an upcoming podcast, I'll talk about the experiences I've had in Korea going to these massive professional gaming events where you have 30,000 people cheering fans, wearing team jerseys, the whole pyrotechnics, and it's a professional gaming competition. So when you think about gaming and you think about that as kind of a weak signal of what possibly the interaction that that can generate from new technologies and new innovations, and then you think about the human scale. If I think about gaming and I apply it to tactile, typing, touch, whatever, to auditory speech, to optic, my ability to visualize information or use those as visual cues, you get an idea of an early weak signal what the impact on the human interaction is going to be. What's it going to change? Is it significantly increasing the use of the optic nerve capacity? Is it significantly going to change the role of tactile, typing, feel, touch to auditory? What is the interaction of a human scale? And therefore, you can look at and project out what is the role of a weak signal and what its possible impact would be on the human interaction with that weak signal. And as a side note, when you start talking about performance and signals and speeds, one of the little interesting speed areas that I kind of find humorous is that we've got research engineers at some of the top research labs working on network technologies and network capabilities that are measured in the range of femtoseconds. And what is a femtosecond? Well, one way to think of a femtosecond is it's the time that it took the Concorde, even though they don't fly anymore, but the Concorde flying at the speed of sound to cover the distance of one atom. So you're talking about performance and capacity that's far beyond anything that's available today, and significantly faster and much higher performance than anything that can operate on the human scale. And I think that's just kind of an interesting kind of anecdote is how fast is fast, and what is that going to have as far as impact for us on technologies in the future? So, femtoseconds, the time it takes the Concorde to travel the distance of one atom. Let's move on to segment three and the killer question of the day. And actually, I'm going to pose two questions today. So you're going to actually get a double offering in today's podcast. And they're actually very similar to each other. So they're actually exact opposites. So it's really not two, but let's go ahead and dive in. So the first question is could I standardize a custom product? Is there something in the market that I could potentially standardize that today is offered as a custom product? And this is kind of plays into what I would call the 80-20 rule. So that, I can satisfy 80% of my customers with 20% of the feature functions or capabilities. A perfect example of this is the designer housewares. So we've seen it, all the high-end designers on Fifth Avenue offering, the very unique, very differentiated kind of housewares, whether that be plates or china and silverware or whatever the case might be. And those typically have been very custom, very limited editions, very high priced. But now we're seeing where those same designers that are designing those high-end wares are now offering those same products and same designer goods through such stores as Target. So basically taking what was traditionally viewed as a custom product and then standardizing it and offering it to the masses. And in fact, for Kmart and for Target, those are turning out to be the highest growth areas as far as new sales. So people who want the designer products but don't want to pay for the prices. So that's a perfect example of could you standardize a custom product? And the next question is we're going to talk about could I customize a mass product? So could you take something that's highly that's a mass product that's highly produced, high volume, and could you customize it? And a perfect example of this is kind of the new fad that's coming back around hot rod cars. So you buy a car, it's mass produced, and then you take it and you start spiffing it out with wheels and seats and all kinds of electronics in the car and DVD players and game machines and stereo systems that put out 1,000 watts of sound. You're turning in, or that particular area is turning into being a huge mass market. I mean, not mass, but a huge market from the standpoint of people going off and taking, a mass-produced product such as an automobile, and then customizing it for their own specific tastes. Are there other things that you're working with where you could take what is today a mass product and customize it? For a new market opportunity or to unlock an entirely new area. So again, the two questions. Could I standardize a custom product? And could I customize a mass product? Two new questions that I hope will help you generate the next killer innovation. And with that, we're going to wrap up the show. We're coming up right on 26 minutes. I'm going to try to get this done on time. I apologize for last week's show. I know it went a little long to 45 minutes. So we're going to try to keep this on schedule. This show's coming out on Saturday versus Sunday, since Sunday is Mother's Day. And don't want to be taking time away from my wife and kids tomorrow. So we're going to get the show out today. Next week, I will actually be doing this show from Indonesia, beginning a 3-week trip through Tokyo, Indonesia, Singapore, Bangkok, Hong Kong, and then back to the States. So the next couple of podcasts actually will be coming from Asia Pacific region while I'm on a 3-week trip over there. And hopefully I'll also uncover some new weak signals in the region that I'll include in the upcoming podcast and give you the latest and greatest of what I'm seeing out there in the marketplace. As always, if you have any questions or comments, please send an email. The email address is podcast@killerinnovations.com. Please also visit the website, killerinnovations.com. And I'll have the show notes up there. I'll also include some references to books on scenario planning if you're interested. And like I said, in a future podcast, I'll actually dedicate one podcast to scenario planning and its roles on how to generate innovations from those strategic planning exercises. At the end, following today's show after the music, I'll also be including some other podcast promos. Again, these are podcasts who I find interesting, and hopefully you would find them interesting. And if you're interested, stay on after the music. If not, I'll talk to you next week. And again, please send me comments. I really enjoy the interactions with you. And don't forget to visit Podcast Alley to vote, or you can visit the killerinnovations.com site and vote for this podcast. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Question 1.
How can I become rich and famous?
Question 2.
What's the meaning of life?
Question 3.
Where can I find a fun weekly trivia quiz podcast? The answer to at least one of these questions can be found by visiting www.podquiz.com. That's www.podquiz.com.
Your attention, please. A new edition of the Geek News Central podcast is online now. Be sure to visit www.geeknewscentral.com to subscribe or pick up the latest show. You can call the voicemail hotline at 619-342-7365 to have your comments heard, or call the host directly on Skype. His Skype call sign is Geek News Central. As always, this is a show you are not going to want to miss. Once again, a new podcast by the geek at Geek News Central. www.geeknewscentral.com is available now.